Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Today we are in the Torah section, Bamidbar, which means in the wilderness. It covers Numbers chapter 1 and goes into a good chunk of chapter 4. Now, one of the things to keep in mind as we go through this is it's going to look like a whole lot of arcane details and long lists of people. And they are long lists of people. And you might say arcane details. But one of the key things that we get in this is with any genealogy, and lots of people are into studying genealogy, but why do people study genealogies? One reason is, where do we come from? And also, what has come of it? What has come of all these people in long past? So, as we go through this, just keep those couple of things in mind, that as we study genealogy to find out where we ourselves come from, let's take a look at where Israel has come from. Israel is a people, the people of God, God's work on the planet, and where that work is going. So, one of the things that we see in this, we're starting into the book of Bamidbar, or otherwise known as Numbers, and we've seen lots and lots and lots of numbers here in this discussion. But one of the things, as you notice how this is organized, you wonder, well, from the time frame, this seems like the book of Vayikra or Leviticus was like a giant interlude in between Exodus, because what we're looking at here is really fits back in with the end of Exodus. But here we have this big interlude called the book of Vayikra or Leviticus. Why was that necessary before we get to this? Anyone venture an idea? Yes, Anne.
Tells you how to behave so that you can do the other things that Numbers is telling you to do.
Okay, how to behave. And it's very, very, yes, Daniel.
Well, recall quickly, since the tail end of Exodus identified Aaron and his sons as being priests, Leviticus is kind of, the way I looked at it is, and then certainly, okay, since a priest has not been defined as one exists, now what is it? Like, what is a priesthood? What does it do? And then when you have it defined what it does, you identify the individuals plus what it does. Now you can move forward and live. Leviticus has always been a way of, at least I looked at it as, it's the way in which you will live. Is how you will survive, how you will follow this God that you've been wandering around the wilderness for months on end. What is this, you know, this towering mess of light and smoke and whatnot? What does it mean? So it's the written out version of what you physically have been doing. You've been wandering about from rock to rock and from town to town for months. Now let's write out what you've been physically doing. You will live it in this way. That's how I've always looked at it.
Mm, okay. Yes, Alex.
Okay, last week I found out how much I was worth just as a being walking around.
Yes, now we're going to tax
now
you on that.
I'm actually, what is your real job now? Are you of fighting age? No? Or are you a priest? Are you, okay, if you're 22, are you of fighting age? That's who's counted. But so I'm not invisible, because last week in Leviticus I actually had a value, and then of course the priests are a little more. They started counting them at a month old, but then they can serve when they're 20 to 50.
Was that 30 to 50?
30 to 50. Excuse me. A little wisdom attached to them. So
yes,
I'm getting my mind around it. Yeah, it's
yes.
all.
Although, some value. These days, age 26 isn't what it used to be.
The 20 is the new 30. I don't think they went by that.
Yes. But that is, he brings up a very interesting point, because one would have thought that you would get through the whole book of Leviticus and it's all about whom? The priests. It's all about them, so okay, skip right over it. Except when you get to the end, you realize, no, it's not only about the priests. And remember when we looked at it, that the offerings, the whole first seven chapters of it was about offerings, but it was also, it was about what the people bring and then what the priests do with what the people bring. And one of the things we learn from Vayikra is that the offerings represent whom? People. That's what they're all about. Because the whole name for that, Karban, is the thing that approaches. Well, what is that thing? Us. We are that thing that is approaching, because God wanted to put the Mishkan, the tabernacle, right smack dab in the middle of the people so that they would do what? Stay away? No. So that they would come near. And then we see, like with the Day of Atonement, that all that coming near is drawing people in. But then what is the problem with the people when they need to come in the front door? Come as you are, stay as you are, leave as you are, come back as you are, and back and forth and yo-yo through life. Now, one of the things is about the transformation of people. You come in the door as you are, but you don't stay as you are, because that which you brought in the door gets transformed at the altar. And then its life goes on before it, to the presence, toward the presence. But then on the Day of Atonement, then the sins, transgressions, and iniquities of all the stuff that had come in before, representing all the people camped around it, were then done what? Carried away. So who you were before, when you wanted, your heart was drawing near and wanting to be closer to the Creator of heaven and earth, all of the sins, transgressions, and iniquities, that was carried away out of the camp to be gone. So that's talking about your becoming a different person. So thus, all that stuff that goes on inside of the tabernacle is all about the people outside of the tabernacle. Not about something, oh, they're doing that thing over there. I see the smoke that goes up and smells like they're burning stuff. I don't know what it is they're doing over there, but they can just keep on doing with their own thing. No, it's all about a integrated whole of the people around the Creator of heaven and earth in the middle, and then the Creator wanting everyone to get closer in the process. So that's when we look at this, we see that this is a people that are doing the work inside of the tabernacle, but it is a part of what happens outside of the tabernacle. Yes, Larry.
I'm trying to get the idea behind the layman that approaches is put to death.
Mm-hmm.
So how close can you approach, and is that just a metaphor for changing?
Go back to the little diagram here of the tabernacle. Where do people approach? The thing that approaches, where does it, do you
comes in
get
the
your
east.
Trebuchet and lob it up over the top?
Coming through the east gate.
The gate, right.
And then you stop at the altar.
You might have remembered Yeshua said something about that. About thieves and robbers. Which way do they go in? Over the wall. You're not getting in over the wall. That's death. Trying to lob yourself in over the wall. No. There's only one gate, one door. You enter that way, you're fine.
But then when you read it, it said the layperson.
Right. The layperson that approaches from where? Any other side.
I didn't hear that part.
By that. Because when you go in through the gate, who's camped out in front of the gate? high priests. The high priests are camped out right in front of the gate. And their job is to do what? Guard, but also they're a part of the main functionaries that are going to be taking everything that comes in the door to the presence in the process. But that's a part of the process, is that not the thieves and the robbers are going to come in and, you know, rig the great slot machine in the sky to churn out the jackpot. No, this is a part of a transformation, because that's one thing that we saw smack dab nearly in the middle of the book of Leviticus, right after the discussion of the Day of Atonement, was we talked about those chapters of holiness, chapters 18, chapter 19, about what your behavior is to be different from the people around you, the things that happen of the nations. So it's not okay that you just keep on living just like everybody else does. You can come in that way, but not stay that way. You have to go through the priests to get into the front door. So that's one of the key things as we go through in this book of Bamidbar or Numbers, that what we're going to be looking at, and then we get into the book of Deuteronomy, is the second generation versus the first generation. So since this is like right there at Sinai, this is talking to whom? First generation. Yes, to the first generation. And then when we get to the end of the book of Numbers, where are we talking to at that point? Getting closer to the second generation. You get that handoff to the second generation. Then you go into the message to the second generation, which is the book of Deuteronomy. Yes, Piran, you have a comment or a question?
Is there any significance that all the numbers were even numbers?
The even numbers, yes. So all the odd number people, they just get kind of lopped off. Yes. But it is very interesting that there, you might have noticed that there was one specific number that was exact. And that was what? Yes, the Levite firstborn. And then they made the specific thing of doing the bank reconciliation, so to speak, on the tribe of Levi to say, okay, well, that overage beyond the rounded off number, that had to be rounded back in, and rounded back in through a redeeming of the overage. With the same kind of language as what you saw back in the beginning, as it mentioned just earlier in the passage, with the whole reason that you had the firstborn of Mitzrayim, they suffered in the 10th plague for the Exodus. Their suffering brought freedom from bondage. But because of that suffering, then you had to basically reconcile for that suffering from the people of Israel. And that fell down upon the firstborn. And then that firstborn more specifically pulled out from the Levites, one particular tribe out of that. And then their job specifically was to be the emissaries, the priests, the ones that bring the offerings. And then the high priest, the one that would be the one that not just approached, but then approached fully toward the presence of God. And then from that tribe of Levi, of course, was the friend of God, Moshe. So thus you see this reconciliation out of what this number of the people for a very specific task. And their task was to basically also reconcile in or bring in the world, as you see it, as it the people of Israel expand and become that focal point of all the world that the King Solomon prayed with the inauguration of the temple. So this was the first stepping stone in Egypt on the 10th plague. And then you see Israel gets founded. And then you see later on, it's supposed to be an attraction in of all the world. So it's very interesting as we see what then happens on through the book of Numbers. It is a, you could say, a winnowing process. Yes.
Are you saying the ransom that they paid as shekels was the reconciliation?
There's reconciling because they, like she's noticing there, well, it's a rounded off figure. But this number of the firstborn was very exact. Mm-hmm. And then it got rounded back to the rounded off number. But then that ransom then had to be paid, just like you saw the same kind of ransom happen with the firstborn of Egypt. So this is, say, okay, the Levites are to, you could say, reconcile all of Israel to God through their service in the tabernacle, and then a specific family inside of the Levites serves inside the tabernacle, and then a specific person inside the Levites, of or the priesthood specifically, is the one who then goes in closer to the presence of God. So it's all about, there is a substitution that has to be done to bring the greater freedom in for the people. And hopefully we'll see it as we go through this book, that it comes to be a little bit closer. And as we see through this book, you'll see that there are something we saw touched on in chapters 2 and 3 and going into 4 about these roles of the various families with inside the tribe of Levi. And one specifically, one of those is Kohath. And then we see later on when we get into the book of Bamidbar, some problems with the family of Kohath and specific people inside the family of Kohath. But it is very interesting to see that they are camping close to the tabernacle. They are charged with carrying the most holy things. They are ones that are given a very high responsibility. But as we see as they went on, they weren't happy with that role. They wanted more. So that is a very interesting lesson as we go through this. So one of the lessons that we'll see hit again and again in the book of Bamidbar is, are we happy with the role that we're given? Or do we strive for, do we reach for more beyond those assigned things that we are given? So, yes.
So the ransom represented a payback, like Egypt, they were ransomed with blood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so they're ransomed now with a shekel.
Yes. So this increase, you had the rounded off figure of the tribe of Levi. Then you've got these firstborn here that are being rounded off, brought back to the total that you have with the tribe of Levi. So the tribe of Levi is again being that role of the reconciler, or the one that takes it on.
Like, they take on what?
To take on the burden of the firstborn, because the firstborn is what? It's like with the tithing, with your increases. Is that stuff that we do? Is it stuff that we bring, we produce? No, it isn't. So thus, those things belong to God. But does everything then go to God? What is the one thing that we saw in Exodus and Leviticus related to a firstborn? If you don't redeem them, meaning if you don't acknowledge where they come from, is another way to put that, then what? Basically, it's seized from you. So thus, the firstborn of Israel are ransomed by the work of the Levites, and then the work inside the Levites of the tabernacle. It's all about, you have the presence of God here in the midst of the people. Don't forget what goes on there. And the fact that you as a people that were traveling along with this tabernacle are being sustained, are being brought from a place of bondage to a place of freedom because of the one who's traveling with you. Never forget that. That's kind of the lesson of the ransoming of the firstborn. You know, the firstborn of Israel had to be ransomed because of what happened to the people of Egypt. Then the Levites had to be ransomed for Israel. And then out of these firstborn, then have to be ransomed back in through the Levites. So again, you're remembering where everything and the increase of Israel is coming from. It's a whole lesson of what tithe is about. Where is the increase coming from? So when we just went through a couple chapters ago in Leviticus about chapter 25, about the Shemitah year and the Yobel, the sabbatical year and the Jubilee, what is the whole role of that? To remember where the increase of the ground, the increase of the produce comes from. You know, you are just not the master because you happen to control it. There is a master owner of the land. Yes.
So the Levites were not just a gift from God that says, hey, you can now approach me through these guys, but it's going to cost you, right? So is that what you're saying? We, the tribe, purchased the tribe of Levi? Is that what you were saying?
You're
putting a value
remember,
to that.
Yeah, because remember that the pattern shown on the mountain of the tabernacle, and then all of the things related to the tabernacle, the camp and all the, what we're seeing here, the functionality of it, is pointing to something. Now, that pointing to something, we have the benefit of not just the prophets that talk about this going to happen, but also the apostolic writings that show that this is going to happen, and then with the coming of the Messiah. So we're not just left to wonder, what is this arbitrary buying back and this and that? We basically have the end of the book here. And so now we're kind of looking back to this. And why this is important, because, you know, there are some ideas floating around out there that, you know, this whole part of the blood of the covenant is just a representation of something. It's not a substitution of something. But one of the things that we have with the revelation of the tabernacle here, with the going back to Genesis chapter 6, with the life is in the blood, and then Leviticus, life is in the blood. This thing coming in that you're bringing in these offerings, their blood gets shed. Think about what's going on here. Your life really is in the hands of the creator of heaven and earth. The world can just go on as it is, blissfully ignorant of that, but that does not mean that it is not, or you should say, how many more triple negatives can I use in this? But it means that there is a reality that something is going on. You know, for example, it's kind of like someone has an event and you don't know about it. Did the event actually happen? Yes, of course it did. You just didn't know about it. And then maybe you hear from somebody later, well, didn't you go to the such and such? And like, I didn't know anything about it. Oh, it was great. Man, you should have been there. Well, the tabernacle is sort of like that on earth. The job of Israel is to basically send out the invitations and make people understand why they should want to go to this event. Because the event, otherwise known as the Day of the Lord, is going to happen. And the sad part is that, as we see in the prophets and as we see in the book of Revelation and as we see in Matthew 24 and some of the other apocalyptic passages, that for a lot of people, they'll be shocked. What is this? They'll have no idea what's happening, because they didn't ever got the invitation that this that the day that there was a creator, that the creator is saying enough of this moving away into the path of destruction of the whole world. We're going to hit the reset button, and this reset button has been pressed for 3,500 years and forever. How long then it is until the day of the Lord? That it wasn't just happened yesterday. This has been going for a few thousand years already, that this reset of the world has been happening. So that's what is important to look at this, that what is this pattern being shown here of the redemption of firstborn, redeeming another firstborn, redeeming another firstborn? What is this all showing it? And we have that with the end of the book showing us that there is the ultimate firstborn. There is the Son of God that is redeeming all everything before that. So, thus, when you're saying it's an ultimate tragedy of these various things, like the Egypt with the death of the firstborn there. Well, who is ultimately responsible for the death of the firstborn? God. Who else is responsible for the death of the firstborn? Pharaoh and his predecessors who put up the structure of the pantheon of Egypt that basically set up the situation that then had to be broken. But in the process, that was something that started a chain that would spread to the entire world eventually. But that first link had to be broken. Yes.
If you go back far enough, you can click out further than this, but have you go the sequence of events. So Joseph enslaved the Egyptian people at a time which he saved their lives. The sequence of the years of starvation. They agreed that, okay, we would be your slaves and you be our master to keep us alive. So they voluntarily went into that slavery. However, their children didn't volunteer, but their children remained into slavery. So it was a permanent thing. So the parents got themselves into a situation where the subsequent generations could not legally get out, because that was the agreement they made. And so every successive generation would be permanently under Pharaoh's thumb. Either the new Pharaoh comes, new Pharaoh goes, comes and goes, generations come and go, the thumb never is relented because of an agreement that happened one time by one generation. We know that God does not hold subsequent generations guilty for the previous ones' sins, transgressions, or iniquities. There's going to be some breaking point, some point where God says, enough's enough. Now, in Egypt, of course, they slowly transitioned from all the people, Egyptians being under Pharaoh's thumb, to Israelite being under Pharaoh's thumb. Then you could argue how many of each, you know, all the different, blah, blah, blah. Point is, generally, Israel became the slave. So the Egyptian citizenry, through the sequence of Pharaohs, because the new one showed up, didn't know Joseph, exchanged their slavery. So instead of taking us as slaves, we'll put these Israelites as slaves. And they'll take our burden for us. They'll be the one you have the thumb under. So they had a they exchanged themselves out by giving a switch to Pharaoh. So Pharaoh still retained the thumb pressure on everybody. Again, no one's allowed to get out, per se. So the Egyptian citizenry did their own will, or however, I don't know the mechanism how they did so, to come out of Pharaoh's thumb and replace themselves with the Israelite slaves, and other nations too. They have all these slavery going on here. It's interesting that one generation started it, but they couldn't. There's no way of getting out of it. Other, of course, destroy the Egyptian government. You could kill them all off, then of course you get out. But that wasn't the rebellion. Wasn't the secret. Civil war wasn't going on. So God then said, okay, well, to get them out of it, someone's going to pay for it. Has to pay for this error, or have the Egyptians who would have died back with Joseph. Okay, now somebody's going to go ahead and die in your place. You generation back in Joseph's time, your great-great-great-grandchildren, Howard the firstborn, you will be the ones who will die to pay for this original enslavement by Joseph. So they get slaves, they killed for it. At the same time, now everyone's free, including all the Israelites who are free. But God specifically stated, Israel, I got you out, and now at the very next day, say to the firstborn, they all belong to me, they're mine. Every firstborn now belongs to me. Now, he used the word sanctify, means as the priest we sanctify. So every firstborn now just by default became a priest. As God's, you, now you're going to serve God. It's like the priests serve God. So you all become serving gods. Now they all became God's servants. You came out from under Pharaoh's thumb, now you're under God's thumb, matter speaking. But it was evident with the golden calf that the firstborn really weren't worthy of anything. They weren't really useful. But the tribe of Levi, they said, yeah, I'll follow you, Moses. And they didn't participate in the golden calf. They got their swords. They demonstrated, we will take this position. We will serve God. I think my personal theology is that's probably the moment which God said, yeah, I'll take Levi in exchange for all these firstborns. But much like Egypt, you had to pay to get out of it. Firstborns, you had to pay to get out of it. So here's your exchange, but here's a dollar amount because there are more firstborns than Levites, so you got to pay for the sequence, pay for the difference. But each sequence we get this, at least I get this impression that you're under a burden. To get out of the burden, someone's got to pay for getting out of the burden. It doesn't just release itself, someone's got to pay for it. Either the original Egyptians with Joseph, someone's got to pay for it, their descendants obviously pay for it. Getting the Israelite out of Egypt, someone's got to pay for that. Getting the firstborn under the thumb of God and place them with Levites, someone's got to pay for that. And of course, eventually, getting all of us out of the thumb of our own screw-ups, and Messiah pays for them. But someone's got to pay for getting out of the burdens that you continuously put yourself under. Whether it's generations before put you under, or you put yourself under. Someone's got to pay for that process. It's like taking a vow to God's name. You pay for your vows. You pay for your oaths. It says no one gets out of this without paying for your oaths and vows. They mean something to him. The same principle, that the cycle never ends until someone or something pays for it, makes the exchange for that process or covers the expense, covers the cost. Messiah wasn't foolish when he said, every idle word the man speaks will make an account for it. Everything, lots of out of my mouth. I'm sure yours too. Things I wish I had never said. You got to pay for it. So everything we do, he has a record of it. In which case, you look back, if I look back at my own personal life, we won't go into details. It'd be excessive, okay? The things that I've probably said I shouldn't have. I couldn't pay for them all. I only have one life. You can't die multiple times. You die once. I can't pay for them. I don't have enough times to pay for it. My kids had asked a while back with the whole school shooter. Okay, yeah, he died. He's killed. Well, is that enough? He killed a whole bunch of people. You can't kill a guy more than once. You only kill him once. And it was a discussion about it. But the point is, you make enough screw-ups where you're worthy of some kind of penalty. Somebody or something has to pay for it. Someone's going to take the place. Someone has to cover that expense, cover that cost.
But I mean, one of the key questions is, why?
Why does a price have to be paid? Because the individual who gave over you for whatever you needed. For example, let's start with Joseph example. He gave all this food over, and the people didn't deserve the food, but he gave it to them. Well, how do you pay him back? When somebody gives you something, when God gives you something, how do you return it back to him? How do you say thank you? How do you give it back to an exchange? We send thank you notes modern day. We just send you. Well, I don't. My kids do.
Question though is the thank you enough?
Well, that's a good question, and I can't speak to that. Say thank you, Israel.
But I think the thing is that the prophets make that point clear: is that the thank you is not enough.
It's a conduct has to change
if it is not you actually thanking. In other words, the idea right of Balaam, but the issue of payment is value, mm-hmm. And like with the vows. Why is that a big deal? We talked about that just last time around. The vows are a big deal. The oaths are a big deal because you're saying there is significance behind this promise or this covenant, this contract that you're making. So thus, you are putting value on it. If you think that TV or whatever is valuable, you know, you are willing to pay for it. And if someone is going to give you something of value, one of the things that you can really do to help people understand that is to emphasize the value of it with some sort of a payment of something. Like in our particular business, one of the interesting little things that happens is with when we have an event. When we have an event and we want people to attend, one quick way to get a lot of people to attend is to say we comp them tickets. We just give away tickets. Free tickets. So we get lots of people that will take those tickets. How many people actually show up? A tiny little percentage of those people that we, you know, so I always hear that our events people pulling their hair out because of we get hundreds of comp tickets, but only 10% of those people are showing up. We're like, okay, it's a $5 comp. That attendance rate shot up dramatically. $10, it shot up a lot. Even just a tiny little bit to say, hey, this is of value. Yeah, we're giving you a huge discount on this, but there is value here. So you're emphasizing. That's why you'll see some great thinkers will say, what is money? Money is nothing. It's just paper with something on it. But someone says, maybe you should really think of money as a certificate of performance, meaning that this is something, a TV. Well, I like that TV. I want that TV. So what sort of certificate of performance? I've done something and I performed something and I've gotten these certificates of performance in my wallet. Now I say, wow, I like that TV. So I'm going to go and trade my certificates of performance to that person. And what am I getting? I'm getting the TV. So that person who sold me the TV has performed something because he's given me the TV and I've given him the certificates of performance. So then he can take those certificates of performance and then pay workers to pay factories, whatever, pay rent if he's a retailer to do something else. So in all things short, when we're talking about the vows and oaths and such, you will surely pay your vows. And we talked last time why that's so important, because heaven has made a whole lot of promises to us. And if we just think that those things are just blah, 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 you know, yeah, I go to prepare a place for you, blah, blah, blah. And if I prepare a place for you, blah, 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 I'm going to come and get you and take you where I am, blah, blah, blah. Well, if we think that that's what heaven's promises are about, then that's a pretty bad situation. And Apostle Paul talks about that with the belief in the resurrection. You know, if we do not trust in that Messiah was resurrected, what then is our whole faith in heaven? We're the most to be pitied, because you start rolling the whole thing back. And it's like, well, Day of Atonement goes out the window, so then we're still accountable for sins, transgressions, and iniquities all back on our head again. That the whole promises of I'll remember your sins and your iniquities no more. Well, then that's out the window. And then you know, as it goes down, so we have this point that if heaven's promises mean nothing, then we've got a huge problem. So thus, when we make promises, we should keep them, because just as heaven has made lots of promises to us, thus we keep our promises with other people because we value those things. So thus, when you're seeing, when we got through the whole book of Leviticus about the life being in the blood, and then the key life being in the blood represented in the Day of Atonement, thus we see that this is something of huge value that heaven is doing. Heaven is valuing whom? Us. Heaven is valuing us. So heaven is doing a huge value exchange here on earth. And starting with these various value exchanges that Daniel was just talking about, one after another, after another, and after another. But just trading something of value for heaven is not enough, because that is indeed what all the pagan nations do. You bring the gift, you pull the heavenly handle on the slot machine, and out come all your blessings. Well, that may be the way that the world thinks that the divine world works, but like Isaiah is a classic example of that, even in the first chapter, you know, where it goes to the point, if you start treating heaven like that, then you get the response of heaven saying, I hate your feasts. I don't want, like in Psalm 51, you know, you're not pleased with sacrifices, but then goes on to say, well, I'll offer the sacrifices. But what happened in between? The contrite heart happened in between. Once you turn it around and you are actually realize, hey, I have veered off course from heaven. That's what heaven wants. Heaven wants the turnaround, to us to come back around. And thus, when we truly are back again, delivering the carbon, the offering, to the dwelling place of God, that is us. That's just not stuff that we're delivering to the door. Heaven doesn't need our stuff. Heaven needs us. Yes.
As you gave your example regarding the pagan slot machine thing.
the pagan slot machine.
That's a good, phrase. So, and the primary difference is that, well, one of the primary differences is that each example, which we were just discussing earlier, and which you also brought up as well, the specific things which are being exchanged for, it's human life that's being exchanged. Mm. It's not like, you know, here's my pig, here, you know, give the slot machine, slaughter it, give me $1 million. It's not stuff I'm getting, as a pagan philosophy is, give me stuff. This is about stuff. This is strictly about human life. So human life to human life to human life. It's all about the life itself being exchanged, or changing hands, changing responsibilities. Because, and it makes sense to some degree, in that the people, we go back when, my previous example earlier, regarding the descendants of the generation that sold themselves to Joseph, those descendants would have an inherent obligation or sense of value or thankfulness to Joseph, even though the many generations later, because they themselves would never have even existed had Joseph not sold the people food, because they'd all be dead. They didn't even be here. The idea that I only exist today, modern day me, Daniel, because my parents did. And they only exist because of what their parents did. And they, going back, at some point in time, if anything earlier on in the chain fell apart, I wouldn't be here. And nor would anybody else. We all have our own chains to go back, family trees. So all those sequences, you can always feel the sense of perpetual obligation to the individuals who lived before you, who did whatever they did, some good, some bad. But you always have these things which happened before you. You think, well, I only exist because of these things. I've talked to my children not too long ago, some of them were, that God uses our mistakes in our past. Wow, that mistake was terrible. My whole life changed because of my ancestor, my grandpa, whatever, did something, and whole world and family's world changed and changed course, and I exist now because of it. Had that not occurred 2-3 generations ago, I wouldn't be here today. Mm-hmm. Somebody else might be somewhere else, but I wouldn't be here. So even those errors result in the blessing you have, that you exist. And so there's always a sense of human obligation or thankfulness, I should say more accurately, that I'm alive because of what happened before me. And this idea that unlike the pagan slot machine idea is that, you know, God, get me through, or whatever God you're worshiping, give me through this current situation because I need more crops, more food, more rain, whatever. I want after. It's the idea that God's saying, I don't care about your crops, you know, your stuff, your houses, your whatever. It's you, you're the individual that we're exchanging. You're the person I care about and valuing. And each of these exchanges of persons, exchange of individuals of redemption cycle is to save more people, to get the people themselves. That's his accumulative goal, which is why we have this whole Shavuot counting cycle, right. Is the accumulation of counting of people, which is what he does.
Yeah, and that's what he's talking about there, that legacy that goes on from one person to the next is what the whole point of what we just looked at here today with all those genealogies, etc., that there was the starting point for each one of these people. And you know, some ancient commentators have noted in this that one of the great significant lessons that you get from this particular passage we're looking at today is that your particular legacy that you have is the passing on of the knowledge of God and the connection to God from one generation to the next, which gets us into where we're going to go with our next, you know, we're going to be focusing a little bit closer on Numbers chapter 1, and specifically with this making sense in the census, that really you are more than a number. And so for our next passage, we're going to take a look at three parables that are found in Luke chapter 15. Now all the tax collectors and sinners were coming near to listen to him. But the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So he told them this parable, saying, "What man among you, if he has 100 sheep and has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open pasture and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost.' I tell you that in the same way, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. Or what woman, if she has 10 silver coins and loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house to search carefully until she finds it? When she's found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin which I lost.' In the same way, I tell you that there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents." The younger of them said to his father, "Father," a man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me a share of the estate that falls to me." So he divided his wealth between them. And not many days later, the younger gathered everything together and went on a journey to a distant country. And there he squandered his estate with loose living. Now, when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country and began to be impoverished. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of the country, and he sent him into the fields to feed swine. And he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him. But when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have had more than enough bread, but I am dying here with hunger? I will get up and go to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men.' So he got up, came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to the slaves, 'Quickly bring out the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet. And bring the fattened calf. Kill it and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found.' And they began to celebrate. Now the older son was in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. And he summoned one of the servants, began inquiring what these things could be. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf, because he received him back safe and sound.' But he became angry and was not willing to go in. And his father came out and began pleading with him. But he answered and said to his father, 'Look, for so many years I have been serving you, and have never neglected a command of yours. And yet you have never given me a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your wealth with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him. And he said to him, "Son, you've always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has begun to live. It was lost and has been found." So we see with these particular three accounts here as to what heaven's concern is about the whole, all 100, and the one out of that 100, that remnant of that 100 sheep. Concerned about all the coins, so to speak, but then also concerned about the one coin that was lost. And then concerned about the two sons, but also being very concerned about the son who was lost. And in that case, ran away, squandered it, just basically gave a huge gesture to his father. And yet, what was his father's response? Ran to him. And the older brother, I mean, you just rightly say, "Hey, look, your son divorced himself from this family. He just ran off, took all of who you, your value, you know, basically did an advance on his death to get his inheritance ahead of time," which, huge affront, huge cultural faux pas, declaring the father dead, so to speak. And yet, what was the father's response? Dead, but now he's alive. So now you can see a lot of what the prophets say, like Hosea, in lots and lots of words and with great, wonderful detail and emotional detail in the prophets, like Hosea, about this particular thing that's expressed here through the Messiah, that that which was lost, those that were not my people, have again become called my people. Yes, Alex.
Back to what we started with, hitting rock bottom.
Yes.
I mean, not only was he working with the pigs, which was just great for someone in Israel, but he was eating pigs' food.
Yes.
He wasn't even eating the pigs. So he had his, yeah. He saw it. He saw the light.
Yes. Definitely saw the light. Yes. Larry.
One of the things that about that I always thought was poignant was that he said to his second son who had stayed with him, your brother's not going to inherit it. He already had his inheritance. You got all of mine now.
Yes.
You got it all.
Yeah.
It also reminds me of these two parables in Matthew where the man goes out and finds a great treasure, but the merchant was already out there looking for great value, and they both met each other, essentially. I mean, not in the parable, but that's the way I think of it. That they, not only are we looking for him, he's looking for us. And I think that's really great.
Yes, he's looking for us. And there you got encapsulated what all this discussion is with the tabernacle. He is looking for us. Kind of like what you see in Isaiah when it talks about, you know, search for the Lord where he, when he may be found. So where he may be found is key with that place where he has put his name. And one of the things we often talk about related to tabernacle, the temple, is it is built up in actuality with what? As the Apostle Peter puts it, living stones, meaning us. So that is what heaven is looking to do in building up the world. So one of the things that we'd take a look at as we kind of close out here is another interesting parable found over in Luke chapter 12, first 8 verses of that. So in the midst of kind of a typical thing you saw in chapter 11. It ends there with the some of the Perushim, some of the Pharisees that were very hostile to him. So some were hostile, some were his disciples. So going into chapter 12, under these circumstances, after so many thousands of people had gathered together that they were stepping on one another, he began saying to his students, first of all, beware of the leaven of the Perushim, which is hypocrisy. But there is nothing covered up that will not be revealed, and hidden that will not be known. Accordingly, whatever you have said in the dark will be heard in the light, and what you have whispered in the inner rooms will be proclaimed on the housetops. I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body, and after that have no more that they can do, but I will warn you whom to fear. Fear the one who, after he is killed, has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 cents? Yet not one of them is forgotten before God. Indeed, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So do not fear. You are more valuable than many sparrows. And I say to you, everyone who confesses me before men, the Son of Man will confess him before the angels of God. But he who denies me before men will be denied before the angels of God. And it goes on and talks about the mission of the students of the Messiah and the people of God in the world, which is to do what? Send out the invitation, so to speak. Send out the invitations into the entire world. And the interesting corollary to this particular passage, the parallel version of it, is found over in Matthew chapter 10. It's very interesting as to what the apostle has in his version of this account, in this parable, in Matthew chapter 10, starting in verse 16. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves. But beware of men, for they will hand you over to the courts and scourge you in their synagogues. And you will be even brought before governors and kings for my sake, as a testimony to them and to the nations. But when they hand you over, do not worry about how or what you are to say, for it will be given you in that hour what you are to say. For it is not you who speak, but it is the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father is child, and children will rise up against their parents and cause them to be put to death. You will be hated by all because of me, because of my name, but it is the one who has endured to the end who will be saved. But whenever they persecute you in one city, flee to the next. For truly I say to you, you will not finish going through the cities of Israel until the Son of Man comes. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a slave above his master. It is enough for the disciple that he become like his teacher, and a slave like his master. If they have called the head of the house Beelzebul, how much more will they malign the members of his household? Therefore, do not fear them, for there is nothing concealed that it will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. For what I tell you in the darkness, speak in the light, and what you hear whispered in your ear, proclaim upon the housetops. Do not fear those who kill the body but are unable to kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not 2 sparrows sold for a cent, and yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father? But the very hairs on your head are all numbered. So do not fear, you are more valuable than many sparrows. Therefore, everyone who confesses me before men, I will also confess him before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will deny him before my Father who is in heaven. Well, do not think I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be the members of his own household. He who loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me, and he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life will lose it, and he who has lost his life for my sake will find it. It reminds me of something that I heard from a lady in her 80s over in the UK in the past 2 years of the pandemic, as they were cracking down harder and harder and harder upon your ability to move around or do much of anything. And this reporter was asked this, like, well, aren't you afraid of dying? And she said, well, there are things that are worse than death. And that is one of the things that we're talking about here, is that we are faced here again in these days with things that are worse than death. Things are worse than losing the job. Things are worse than being ridiculed in public, being called, you know, Luddite, backward, someone who's just totally out of touch with reality. But in the end, what do we never want to lose track of? Lose track of where things come from and where they are actually going. So just like in this account, in these accounts, in these parables that we're looking at, this heritage that's being passed on that we read about back in Numbers, this is being passed on from generation to generation to generation. And it's very interesting because you'll see in ancient commentaries, when they say take a census, literally it means seize the head, or another way it could be translated is lift up the head. Nasa Rosh. So there was a controversy because some ancient commentary said, well, what it's talking about is the lift up the head means to off with his head. But another way you can say it is to lift up the head, like you read back in the account of Yosef when he had the dreams that he was interpreting for his fellow cellmates there in the prison. And very interesting that the same term, the same idiom in Hebrew was used both ways. Both of them had their head lifted up. Just one was lifted up, meaning honored. Another one's head was separated from his body and lifted up for public display. And the very interesting thing is when we go through Numbers, this is kind of what we're going to see. Two cases of lifting up of the head for honor and for correction. And when we see that when we take the census yet again, when we get down to Numbers 26, there are tribes that went up in population. There's a number of tribes that went down in population. And as we go through the book of Numbers, we'll see why there was these reductions in numbers of the people over time. And just like what we read here in the accounts and the parables from the master on this, we'll see, yeah, there was the cases where the people loved their life more than the kingdom of God. And when we see that counting soldiers in the army, this army's first job is to do what? Stand. Because one of those things that you see when the selection of the army is who is left standing there to pick from. Because there are a number of people who get disqualified from service. It's very interesting. There was this general, retired now, is one of the first generals of the special forces, served in Vietnam, etc. And he was decrying the fact that under one of the recent assessments, that basically one quarter of the potential population, not just of those who self-select and decide to enlist in the armed forces, are even capable of serving. Because, you know, they can't move. They're just not healthy. And that is a situation that we in the people of God, are we just not able to even stand up or to serve? And when we go through this book of Bimidbar, we will see a lot of these examples of the time to stand up and to serve. And those who stood up, like we saw back at the Golden Calf, the tribe of Levi did what? They stood up. They were a rallying point for the whole nation. Then we'll see when we get down to the end of the book, when the spies go into the land, there were two who stood up among those spies. 10 did not. So that is one of the lessons as we go forward, is as relevant today as it was at that particular time. So when we go through and we see all of these particular stories and accounts, that we'll see that, yeah, there were 12, 13 tribes. You count those half tribes in there. But there was one people. Yeah, the differences of them. You see in the prophecies that were given to Yaakov of what the characteristics of each of the sons that would become the heads of these tribes originally were like, and what their characters were like. But they were of one people. So we think about the founders of this particular country that we're in here in the United States, modeled a lot of it on what the account of the patriarchs in Israel was about, of the different colonies becoming united, yet separate, individual, yet a part of the whole. And one of the interesting things that was brought to my attention that came out of a very silly poll that was put out is like, well, where in Europe are the people that are most likely going to feed you if you come over to visit, actually serve you something? And they did of the polls, and not the polls from Poland, but they polled the people. Yes. And in Central Europe, Eastern Europe, they were more likely to actually serve you something. But in Scandinavia, less likely to not likely at all to serve you. And it's very interesting. This Swede was reflecting on this and is saying, well, you know, a lot of people sort of think that the idea of socialism is about just collectivism. But he's saying, well, not really, because people get this idea of Germany with national socialism and Russia with the global socialism, workers of the world unite idea that became the USSR and its satellite states. So you get this idea of forced collectivism, which is true. But when you actually go back and you look at some of the original eggheads of the idea, Marx and Engels, it was about actually individualism. I need to be free to pursue what I want to do. And that there is these chains of, as you would say, the chains of Das Kapital, of those that wield the wheels of capitalism that are holding you back and making you be less free in this. But the problem, though, is that as it rolls down, that's where the whole collectivism comes out of it. But it starts with the rigid individualism to begin with. So your idea of, if you are an individual, are you actually a part of a whole, and are you all working together or working for your own against each other? And that's one of the key things that comes out of, you could say, the Judeo-Christian ethic that comes right out of the stuff that we're reading here today, of where it proceeds from. Yes, we are separates, but we are a part of and looking out for the other, versus we are separates and I want to be self-actualized, to reach my potential. And for that, the things have to be redistributed within society to make that happen. So thus, you've had those great colonies like the Plymouth colony that started out with that idea, yes, like in Acts chapter 2 and 3, where they had things in common, everything in common. That's great. But the problem is that as those things progressed on later, you had Paul mentioning after a point, look, if you don't work, you don't eat. Because you had some that did not have this, we're all in this together, even though we are all individuals, we are all helping each other. Wherever there's a need, we just jump in and help. But then some take advantage of that situation. So where we then come as an army, now I just had to say shamefully, I did not serve. But when you hear the accounts of those who do serve, and hear some of my relatives that were in actual combat talking about that, it's like, you know, the great movie thing of the great hero that runs off and yeah, 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 and this and that and the other on his own, that doesn't work. That doesn't work. The great teams that actually do work are the ones that are always looking out for each other. Because even if you see SWAT teams in action, or if you see any sort of our great elite special forces in action, those are very small groups of people. But what are they always doing? If you watch a SWAT team, when they go into a house, into a dangerous situation, what do they all do? Their hands are always on the back of the guy in front of them. Why? So that your compatriots know where you are and that they know somebody has their back in any given situation. And in all the elite forces, they know that you don't move unless your other compatriots are moving with you. So that what? You all have each other covered in this sort of case. So that's when we look through and we see it in numbers, when it's talking about an army, you think, oh, well, this is just about invading this and that and the other. No, these things apply in life. They apply in life. And as we see coming down into the days of the Lord, when it's talking about, well, who's able to stand? Is it just you standing up there by yourself? One of those things that can help you stand is for other people to be standing with you. But as we just saw in the warnings from these passages from the Gospels, we also have to be careful to not take our stand if other people around us are also not taking a stand. That being a huge issue that we are, as they call it, peer pressure in years past, but this groupthink effort, well, we will not move if no one else is moving. We don't want to stand out. So those things kind of work both directions on that. To have the three-stranded cord that is not easily broken, that we can have help and support when we need it to move forward and to stand. But then also, on the other side, if you have to stand and no one else is around you is standing, can you actually do that? So those are two sides of the same issue and the same ethic. And it's great that we get to see those exemplified here in the book of Numbers and in the Gospels and the prophets, etc. Because one of the passages that we just read in passing comes from Micah chapter 7. And Micah chapter 7 is talking about a time period where, when it's talking about father against sons and whole family against you, yeah, it was happening in dark, dark times of Israel's history, ancient Israel's history, modern Israel's history. There have been times where, yes, that's happened. And you know, we're watching some history of Eastern Europe, and my goodness, the Stasi in East Germany, wow, they were really into it. And even the account we heard about that when the files of the Stasi were eventually opened after the collapse of the Eastern Bloc and communism and the Soviet Union, this lady found out that the informant was her own husband. So, yeah, that's how the Stasi found out about her. It was her own husband was keeping all kinds of records on her over time. She never had any idea that was happening. Yes, Alex.
Time, 4 years after Vietnam, and I registered as a conscientious objector. I have no idea why. I wanted to smoke weed. I didn't want to go fight. My uncle was livid. I don't think they even do a registry anymore. Anyway, you know, that was one of those high points in my life, right?
Yes. But you know, it is interesting. You talk about conscientious objector. I come from a tradition that's basically a watchword, and that's a great goal to be a conscientious objector. But that's kind of the thing that I also come from, a legacy of conscientious objectors that were like head into battle. You might have heard of a movie that was called Hacksaw Ridge, which is a true account of World War II. That was a conscientious objector that went in and unarmed, you know, basically rescued an entire, I think it was a battalion. He was a medic that carried down good part of a battalion and even enemy soldiers in the process out of the combat zone. And my own uncle, I guess it would be my great uncle, was a same thing, conscientious objector, medic in the Italian campaign during World War II. And the only survivor out of his whole regiment, the whole regiment was wiped out. So, yeah, that's one of those things that, yeah, even if you have your own ethic, still charging forward into the fire to help other people. So, yes, that's something to inspire us all that, yes, when it's talking about who will be able to stand on the day of the Lord, that the standing really starts now, the quote, small stuff. So any last thoughts as we close out here today? All right, well, let's close in prayer. Father God, we thank you and praise you for giving us your words of life. And Father, we just ask that you teach us each day to stand up for your truth and your word, to stand for the things that you've taught us is the right way to go against the ways that everything else and everybody else may want us to go. Father, we thank you for covering over our sins, transgressions, and iniquities through the blood of your Son, Yeshua. We thank you for allowing us to come with confidence into your presence through his blood. We thank you in his name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.